Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. Just how popular is China in global terms? The answer to that question seems obvious, at least here in the United States. The past several years have seen our dominant view of China change dramatically. More and more, U.S. officials and ordinary Americans are gravitating away from the idea that China can be a constructive actor on the world stage, and towards the notion that Beijing has become a serious strategic competitor, and perhaps even an adversary, not just of the United States, but of the Western liberal order more broadly. And that realization is dawning among America's partners in the West as well. Publics in countries like the UK and Australia now hold profoundly negative views of China, as a Pew Research Center poll that was released this summer highlighted. What accounts for this shift? A great deal of it can be attributed to China's increasingly aggressive foreign policy maneuvers under the guidance of its current president and Communist Party Secretary Xi Jinping. The PRC's malfeasance and disinformation during the coronavirus pandemic contributed significantly as well. And more countries in the West have become worried about the risks of extensive dependence on a nation that has proven itself to be an intrusive and a manipulative economic partner. But outside of Washington and European capitals, this is far from the prevailing view. In fact, throughout what is collectively known as the Global South, encompassing Latin America, Africa, and parts of Asia, China is significantly more popular than the U.S., as a number of recent studies and polls have documented. To find out why, I spoke with Eric Olander. Eric is a journalist with more than three decades of experience with some of the world's top news organizations, including CNN, France 24, and the BBC. A fluent Mandarin speaker who now resides in Vietnam, he is the editor-in-chief of the China Global South Daily Brief, a daily newsletter looking at the PRC's political, economic, and military relations with the rest of the world outside of the West. It's indispensable reading for government officials, think tankers, and members of the media alike. All of that makes Eric the go-to person on China's global maneuvers and the logical person to explain China's true standing in the developing world. So I was delighted when Eric agreed to come on the show and let me pick his brain on this topic a little bit. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Let's begin with that divide in perceptions I mentioned. It's hugely significant because policymakers in Washington tend to think that the rest of the world thinks exactly the way they do. And so today, with the U.S. embracing the need for great power competition with China, there's this reflexive notion that the rest of the world feels the same way, but it doesn't. What are the numbers and what are the polls telling you?
The sense in Washington is absolutely delusional. And what they're misreading is when they see these Pew surveys, which are mostly of advanced industrial economies. So they'll see surveys from Australia, from South Korea, from Japan, from Europe, from Canada, and they all point to terrible public approval ratings for China. And so what ends up happening is that a lot of public policymakers then say, see, the world is against China. But what you're missing in all of that is these vast swaths of the global South, the Americas, South Asia, here in Southeast Asia, in Africa and the Middle East, where the views are far more complex. And let's just focus on Africa and the Middle East in particular. So Africa, we've had a series of surveys just this year that have come out. So there's two in particular that we can focus on and that your listeners can go look up themselves. One is from Afrobarometer, and they are by far the most credible in the space. And then the other one is the Ishikovitz Family Foundation survey out of South Africa. Both, for the first time this year, have put the Chinese ahead of the United States in public opinion approval. So 63-60 in the Afrobarometer poll. And then again, what's interesting in the Ishikovitz poll is that it was among young people, and Africa is a continent of teenagers. And so the perceptions of the Chinese were outstripping the Americans. On the Arab Barometer poll, which is very interesting, and this is the surveys that are done by Princeton University, consistently the Americans fall behind the Chinese. Now that is a little bit more complicated because of the Americans' long tortured history in the Middle East. So those emotions get wrapped up, and the Chinese have a very kind of light touch in the Middle East in many ways compared to the Americans. So it's easy for them to poll better in that respect. And sometimes people are just saying, I like the Chinese because I don't like the Americans. So again, you got to dig deep on some of these things. But at the end of the day, the feelings about the Chinese are far more nuanced and complex than most people in the Beltway seem to understand.
All right. So here's the $64,000 question. Why is that? What accounts for these discrepancies that you talk about, the discrepancies in perception? Why do publics in the global South see China so differently from the way we do you think?
There are a lot of reasons, but let's just start with the superficial ones. First and foremost, the Chinese are there. You see the Chinese. The people-to-people contacts are high. The brands are there. The infrastructure is being built. The presence of the Chinese, the physical presence, is there everywhere for you to see. So people see the roads, they see the bridges, they see the ports, they have the Huawei phones. In places like Africa, it's not even the government, it's even the private sector is very robust. So you look at Boomplay, for example, which is the number one music service. That's a Chinese-owned music service that's kicking Spotify and Apple's butt in Africa. They're seeing innovation from the Chinese. They're seeing, you know, there's a brand new air bridge that just opened up between Addis Ababa and Changsha that's now bringing Kenyan coffee. They've just sold the first Kenyan avocados into China. They're seeing innovation in the policies. Lots of enthusiasm. We just had 2 weeks ago, there was a 8-nation live video connection with the Chinese space station for African youth. Now, the Americans have the potential to do all of this stuff, but the Americans just aren't showing up. And this is what we hear consistently throughout the global South, here in Southeast Asia, in the Americas. They want to see more engagement from the United States. They want the Secretary of State to come here. They want businesses to be here. They want to see that competition. But the Americans just aren't showing up in any meaningful way. And so what ends up happening, particularly in places like Southeast Asia, is that people make very strategic, calculated decisions about what's in their national interest. Do I go with the aspirational power? That's the Americans who are talking about all these wonderful things about what could be. What could be in governance? What could be in democracy? What could be in trade? What could be with, you know, with investment? Or do you go with the guy who's on the ground in front of you? And in Southeast Asia, for example, you look at the trade volumes between the Chinese and the Americans, and they're orders of magnitude higher with the Chinese. And so at the end of the day, people are going to make those decisions in what's in their interest and what they see on the ground in front of them. Now, let me be very clear. People have very, very complex views. One of the problems that we have as Americans is we believe in these simple narratives, good versus bad, with us or against us. There's always a story to be told as part of it. That doesn't work in these parts of the world. This good and the bad about the Chinese can sit side by side one another. And you'll hear the views of the Chinese where they'll say, you know, I love the roads and I love the phones and I love the engagement, but I don't like the corruption. I don't like the lack of transparency. I don't like the labor issues, you know, and those sit right side by side. They're not mutually exclusive. It's a both and, not an either or.
I want to stay with Africa for a minute because your newsletter covers Africa extensively and takes a look, I think a really excellent in-depth look at Chinese activities and influence throughout the continent. There's a tremendous amount of there, so to speak. Can you talk a little bit about what Beijing is doing on the continent and what local perceptions of the PRC there are and were as a result?
So China's presence in Africa is not something that can be boiled down to a singular kind of description because Africa is 54 countries, 1.4 billion people, very, very. Let's just kind of run through the relationship as it is today. A lot of people have misperceptions. There is no Africa. Let's be very clear here. About 63-64% of all Chinese trade is concentrated in just 5 countries, with about a third of that concentrated in just 2 countries. So China's relationships in Africa are highly distorted. We saw this on vaccine distributions. For the bulk of the pandemic, 60-70% of the vaccine distributions went to just about 10 countries, mostly in North Africa. In terms of loans, for example, we always talk about the Chinese predatory lending and debt trap diplomacy. When you look at the numbers, actually, only about 10 countries have extensive Chinese debts. And even within those 10 countries, take Angola out of it. Angola accounts for about a third of all Chinese lending in Africa. So the other 9 countries, Kenya, Nigeria, Zambia, Ethiopia, the amount of Chinese debt really never crosses the single digits. So again, these perceptions oftentimes are not aligned with the facts, and the relationships are highly distorted, concentrated in resource exporting countries. Nigeria is the largest importing country, not surprising because it's 200 million people. It's the largest market. The debt, again, is concentrated in about 10 countries. So that means 44, 45 countries have no Chinese debt. And so when Americans talk about Africa, they end up oversimplifying and oftentimes infantilizing the continent by kind of wrapping it and bundling it all together. It requires some nuance. It requires some sophistication and understanding what's going on, because what ends up happening is that when American policymakers come loaded with all this garbage in their heads about what the Chinese are doing, bad information, misinformation, and they're sitting down across the table from, say, a South African diplomat, and they're talking about predatory lending, and the South African's going to say, what are you talking about? We don't borrow anything from the Chinese. Well, I heard they have a predatory lending problem in Africa. Yeah, that's somebody else. That's not me. That is 44, 45 countries. Okay. So again, we have to start looking at this at a much more granular level. You know, the Chinese 15 years ago looked at Africa. They don't look at Africa anymore. They look at Nigeria. They look at Kenya. They look at it at a much more, even within Nigeria, Kenya, and these others, they're looking even on sub-regional levels. So we have to do better. And again, in the State Department, they are pretty good at doing this. The problem in the State Department is they're understaffed. And this is just a chronic ongoing problem. When you go over to the Hill, I don't know what happens, but you know, there's a huge intellectual gap. And I'm encouraging people on the Hill and other stakeholders in the think tanks to have that more nuanced understanding of the Chinese engagement in Africa in particular. Same applies, by the way, to South America and also to the Middle East as well. Once we move back from the regional and zoom into the sub-regional, it gets far more nuanced and much more interesting, actually.
To that point, the Global South is more than just Africa, right? And you concentrate a lot of your work on Africa, but we're also talking about the Middle East and we're also talking about Latin America. Beijing is charting significant gains in those places as well. So what are we seeing there in those regions in terms of Chinese popularities and local perceptions of Beijing?
So the way that we define the Global South is the G77. Basically, take out the G7. For us at the China Global South Project, we're not focusing on the G7 and the advanced economies. We focus on the G77. What China's doing and where they see opportunity is they see that the United States and Western Europe to many degrees. And the reason I say Western Europe is because Europe in many ways on China is quite split. Eastern Europe, the Hungarians, the Serbians are very much leaning into the Chinese, whereas again, we see in the Western European side a starkly different view on that. So there are in Europe very, very different perceptions of the Chinese that are important to understand as well. But from our point of view, what the Chinese are doing now more and more is they're reorienting the international order to be more aligned with its interests. This has been a process that's been underway for at least a decade, if not more. Xi Jinping has really, you know, leaned into it and stepped into the gas. And the war in Ukraine has just accelerated this even more. So we've just saw, obviously, this week was a very important week. Xi Jinping stepped back onto the international stage for the first time in 971 days. Very, very important dynamic. I called it an inflection point, because the nature of international diplomacy from this week forward is going to change. That is, the United States and the United Kingdom and the European Union are going to show up at G20 conferences now, and there's going to be a guy on the other end of the table that they're not going to be happy to see. And they haven't had that for 2 or 3 years now. They've had the room to themselves. They don't have the room to themselves. And it's going to be very important. And again, the domestic politics in China demand a strong response to the United States as well. So I think we're going into a much more contentious period. And the Global South is critical for the Chinese to build this coalition to support them in these more contentious international conditions that we're going into. And so what does this look like? It looks like that at the United Nations Human Rights Council, you know, there was a dispute that came out this week. 20 countries backed the Chinese in supporting them on Xinjiang. Again, 20 is interesting because that's a much lower number than previous letters that were in the 40s and the 60s, but still, coalition of 20 countries. It's issues on Huawei. It's the issues on COVID-19 with the World Health Organizations. It's trade issues. It's setting up now these parallel institutions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the BRICS, the New Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Global Development Initiative, the Global Security Initiative. I mean, we can keep going on and on and on. The Chinese are setting up an alternative international system that is led by them. They have their own SWIFT system. They have the Beidou satellite navigation system that's outside of GPS and Galileo. And so again, we're seeing all of this. And what they're doing very effectively is tying in with their trade, tying in with their investment, tying in with their lending policies, the Belt and Road and the engagement in this parallel international order, which is gaining traction.
So you mentioned the Belt and Road, which is China's flagship foreign policy initiative. And it looms extremely large here when we talk about the Global South, because since its launch in 2013, the BRI, as it's commonly known, has grown to encompass a multitude of infrastructure and development and other projects in virtually every corner of the globe. And the scope here, I think, is important for listeners to understand, because the numbers tend to vary very widely, but experts put the total value of the BRI at anywhere from $4 to $7 trillion. And that's an enormous amount of money. And it begs the question, how is this project doing, both in real terms, as in the dividends that it's providing to China itself, and in the context of Beijing's soft power and its reputation abroad?
The beauty of the BRI is that it's a Rorschach test. There is no office of the BRI on Chang'an Avenue in downtown Beijing across from the foreign ministry. There is no blueprint for it. It is a little bit like the global war on terror. It can be anything that you want it to be. BRI is very much the same way. So let's kind of talk about where BRI is. 9 years old coming up next month. So, you know, it's not even 10 years old. So just the speed that they've moved in less than a decade is quite admirable. The numbers you quoted, $4 to $7 trillion, by the way, that's on the high end. Most experts think is it's less than $1 trillion of what they've actually spent. So somewhere the, you know, $600 billion to $800 billion. Again, nobody's really sure. There's no transparency. We don't know. So number one, it's a Rorschach test. Who knows what it is? It can be anything you want it to be. Some people see it as a trade initiative. Some people see it as a outlet for excess Chinese capacity. Some people see it as a military thing. But let's talk about where we are today and what the BRI is in terms of what we have on the ground right now. So we have established trade routes with infrastructure. That's the thing that most people talk about. So when you look at the standard gauge railway connecting to the port of Mombasa, connecting to Costco ships, all of that is, that's the physical, the traditional maritime trade, where basically raw materials come from the global south, go to China, they're manufactured, and then finished goods come back around again. That's the traditional sense of it. That's very much in play right now. Then you've got the Health Silk Road. And that really came alive much more during the pandemic, and that was expedited quite quickly during the pandemic. And that's the shipment of Chinese vaccines. And now Chinese health personnel, it's Chinese pharmaceutical factories are being set up all over the world. That's all the Health Silk Road. You've got the Digital Silk Road, the DSR. The DSR is all of the cloud data centers, the undersea cables, the peace cable that's connecting Asia to Africa to Europe. And then we've got part of the DSR is also the Space Silk Road. That's a kind of a corollary to it. There's a Space Silk Road and then the DSR, and they overlap a little bit because then you've got the Beidou satellite navigation system that's now being integrated. And all of these things now, what we're seeing is they're coming together. So let me paint you a fictitious scenario of what could happen today, right now, okay, that will bring all of this together. So in Kazakhstan, a buyer wants to buy some Kenyan tea from Western Kenya. So he'll go on to an Alibaba site that is powered by a Huawei network on a Huawei phone. Again, all part of the Digital Silk Road. He'll place the order, put the money using a Chinese cryptocurrency into an escrow account. Again, part of the Silk Road and in financial services that's out there. The order then comes to the Kenyan tea farmer, again, on his Huawei-built network, his Huawei phone, through the Beidou satellite system, and the order's then placed. Barcodes are put onto the T as it's then loaded up at the Inland Container Depot in Naivasha, built by China Exim Bank money, put on the standard gauge railway, tracked all the way by the Beidou GPS system to the port of Mombasa, which has been refurbished by the Chinese, and then onto a Costco ship. Unloaded at a port in Central Asia, overland on railroads built by the Chinese and the Silk Road. And here's what's so interesting. That entire transaction happened outside of the Western economic system that's been built up over the past 75 years. No communication went through the Western system. No money went through the Western system. Nothing. That was a parallel transaction that can't be tracked, that can't be traced, and that can't be intervened by the West. You can cut the Chinese off of SWIFT all you want, and that would not have any impact on that transaction. That is the Belt and Road today, not some fantasy about what's going to happen in 10 years. All of that could happen right now, today, and it is happening. And this is one of the reasons why the work that we're doing is so important, is because, you know, I went up to Capitol Hill, and over again, when I met with different congressional staffs, they said, give me a report in 2 pages of what the Chinese are doing. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I can't give you a report in 2 pages because it's so nuanced. It's so complicated. The only way you understand this story is by looking at the tiny minutia of it day in and day out. And that's how you get the texture of what's going on.
So what are the implications here for U.S. policymakers? During the last administration, we saw the first tentative steps towards something resembling a strategy to compete with China and with the BRI. The Biden administration has continued this policy with some significant differences. And we discussed this in our last episode with Josh Rogan of The Washington Post. But in terms of perceptions, neither the last U.S. administration or this one has even begun to fight. America doesn't have a plan for moving the needle in terms of shaping global attitudes towards China. In your opinion, what does Washington need to do in order to excel in this domain, or at least be competitive?
You know, the problem is the United States is not a very good messenger for this. And the credibility of the United States runs rather low. And this is the hard part for Americans and Europeans to really understand: the depths of resentment that people in the global South continue to have to this day about the Cold War and about colonialism cannot be overstated. We, as Americans, do not focus much on this history. We are largely ignorant of this history. Europeans are largely ignorant of this history. So the lecturing and the sermonizing and the sanctimonious attitude that comes is not well received. The problem is that the Americans will walk into, you know, State House X, where, pick your part of the world, and they'll say, we don't want you to deal with the Chinese. We don't want you to buy Huawei. We don't want you to sign on to the Belt and Road. We don't want you to do all these things. You and I have been in some conversations with people like that. And then the immediate question is, okay, what do you have to offer? What are you going to do in place? And there's this awkward silence that befalls them. Are you going to give me $150 million to rip out the Huawei gear out of my network and then to pay for $300 million for Ericsson equipment to come in? Are you going to give me a soft loan for this road? Because in Africa, remember, these presidents and prime ministers are staring down a double-barreled shotgun of demographics. They have to move fast. And now, this is a continent of 19.4-year-olds. Nigeria, it's like the median age is 17 or 18. Teenagers are not patient people by design. So these African presidents and prime ministers are under enormous pressure to deliver. Our system is not optimized for speed. And that's one of the big problems. So there is no alternative to the Chinese in many cases. So the conversation becomes, it's either Huawei or nothing. It's either the China Exim Bank or nothing. And these countries will turn around and say, I can't go to my people with nothing. So I'm going to go with the Chinese. And that's been the story for the past 10 years. Fundamentally, the Americans are making two critical mistakes now in confronting the Chinese. First and foremost, they're not coming with an alternative. You know, again, we've had B3W, now we have PGII. I mean, you go through the acronyms. We had the Clean Network, we've had the Blue Dot Network. I mean, Lord have mercy, we've got acronyms and plans and programs. But the problem is that if you just keep announcing them and actually don't deliver anything with them, people then start thinking you're Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football. Here we go again, another program that's going to confront the malign influence of the Chinese. Okay, we're eager, we want to hear from it. Where is it? Nothing's happened. Because at the end of the day, we as a society, as a culture, are not committed to this. We're not ready to put billions and billions of dollars down in risk insurance to ensure that when GE wants to go and bid for a project in Ecuador, that the U.S. Exim Bank and the United States government is backing it up dollar for dollar. Why? Because that's what Sinosure is doing. So if we're going to try and compete with the Chinese head on in building infrastructure in the riskiest, most volatile countries in the world, you're going to have the full society support behind it. Or in the case of the Chinese, they don't have the full society. They're an authoritarian government, totalitarian government. They don't need the full society, but that's what it takes to compete. We're not going to do that because the politics in both Europe and even Japan and advanced democracies really doesn't have the stomach to throw billions of dollars to build roads in Ecuador and Nigeria. That's just not where we want to spend our money right now. So problem number one is you got to show up, which we're not showing up. Problem number two is that when you show up, you need to play to your strengths. So I was here in Vietnam. I live here. And Wendy Sherman, the number two at the State Department, came and gave a speech right down the street from me, actually, at Fulbright University. Very excited. It was the Indo-Pacific strategy, what the United States is going to do. She said the two priorities for the United States in the Indo-Pacific were climate and health. Climate and health? On health issues, the United States lacks credibility because the outside world has YouTube, and we can see that 50 million Americans don't have health insurance. So in terms of the messaging and the narrative on health, that's not our strong suit. Climate, you know, I mean, listen, we're the largest fossil fuel producer in the world. How do you have a climate message when you're the largest fossil fuel producer in the world? This is not where we're strong. The United States is strong in capital formation, in tech, in entrepreneurialism. Here in Southeast Asia, we are the largest source of inbound FDI. Why isn't Wendy Sherman talking about that? Why isn't Wendy Sherman, you know, setting up tech and innovation centers throughout Southeast Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, you know, where we're connecting with universities? Education is one of our strong suits. Software, services, we're a tech and finance economy. Yet we're talking about competing with the Chinese and building roads and health and climate. These are not our strong suits. And so people don't take us seriously. My point here is not to poop on the United States. The point here is that we need to play to our strengths, and we're not playing to our strengths. And so when we compete in places like Southeast Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and we're not showing up with, you know, teams that can do business formation, trade, that can do, you know, tech and services, that can do innovation, that's where we're strong. But we're not doing that. So again, that's the sense of disappointment that a lot of people have. And the Chinese, say what you want, but they're showing up and they're playing to their strengths. And that's one of the other reasons that people are going, I may not like these people, but I respect them because they're here.
Eric, this has been tremendous. Thank you so much again for taking the time.
Thank you, Alon. It was great to be here and great to talk about, again, a more complex story about China.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.